All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? It's Mark Maron. I'm here. I'm here in Canada still. This is my podcast, WTF. How's it going? Are you all right? Today, I guess in honor of me being in Canada, I'm having a Canadian comedian on, though we did recorded in L.A. Brent Butt is on the show today, and that was fun. I like him. He's always been a nice guy, and I'm glad we got to talk. And he's sort of a big celebrity up here in a way. Well, I don't think he would admit that, but that's coming up. So I have been having, again, a nice time up here just on a spiritual level, if I can say that. I don't know if it's spiritual, just a part of me is relaxed up here because I'm in Canada and the air is not infused with the panic and aggression that seems to be the electrical current kind of like hovering over the United States of America right now. It kind of dissipates at the border and you just kind of deal with life up here. There's just life happening in Canada. Now, I am in Hamilton, Ontario, which look, I don't want to be condescending because I'm not from here and I don't want to be the rude foreigner. But I think I am supported by many people I've spoken to from Toronto and other parts of Canada that Hamilton is not, it's not a high watermark for Canada. It's a little beat up here and it's kind of interesting, but there's definitely it's got its own frequency. I don't know if it's the neighborhoods that I'm staying in or where we're shooting, but there just seems to be a sort of ongoing ragtag parade of frenetic sadness in many manifestations. Just it's weird when your focus is not consumed by what's going on culturally. You can really kind of zero in on people, and there's definitely a bit of a lot of humans twisted by soul sickness of one kind or another wandering the streets here. And it's been kind of interesting and sad, but also funny and nice. How's that? Diplomatic? Anyways, that's my take on Hamilton. But I did have a tremendous experience at a supermarket. Now, before I get to that, I do want to do some business because there's a lot going on for me and maybe for you as well, if you'd like. There's something happening this weekend. Now, I've told you about the movie I made with Lynn Shelton called Sword of Trust, which comes out on July 12th. You can go to swordoftrust.com to see if it's playing near you. But if you're in LA, there's going to be an advanced screening this weekend as part of a retrospective of Lynn's work. This Saturday, June 29th, you can see Sword of Trust at 5 p.m. at the Arrow Theater in Santa Monica, followed by a triple feature of Lynn's films, Your Sister's Sister, Touchy Feely, and We Go Way Back. Then on Sunday, June 30th, there's a double feature starting at 7:30 of Hump Day and Outside In. So you can go to that and enjoy. And from what I understand, Lynn is going to be doing a Q&A at the end of every one of her movies there with people from the movie, hopefully. I am going to try to make the Q&A at the end of the Sword of Trust screening if I can get out of Canada and back to Los Angeles in time. If the shoot doesn't, I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be a pretty harried night for me on the coming up on Friday. We're probably going to be shooting till 3 or 4 in the morning, and then I've got to try to get a morning flight out of Toronto, so I'll be in that haze. That, like, there's no point in sleeping haze. And then you're like, I'll just go right to the airport. And then you're there like 4 hours early. You haven't slept and you realize I've made a terrible mistake. I should have slept for 2 hours somewhere else. And then you sleep uncomfortably on the floor with the floor sleepers. There's always plenty of floor sleepers at airports. And you wonder, how long have they been here really? Are they in between flights? Did they get here just really early for another flight? Do they live here? I don't know, but I might be among those people. We'll see. I don't know how that's going to pan out. The other thing I wanted to tell you is I mentioned a couple weeks ago that there's a new documentary called Blue Note Records Beyond the Notes, and it's opening in Los Angeles this weekend at the Lamley Santa Monica. The filmmakers are distributing this movie themselves, and it's really worth checking out. And these are not paid plugs, my friends. I think that everyone should educate themselves about the beautiful history of jazz. And how it's influenced culture and where it comes from. So I think, because I'm just learning it. I'm not even being some sort of jazz guy. I'm just learning it, right? And I want a cookie. Come on, man. Seriously, what's happening? I'm punchy, you guys. I'm tired. That's what's going on. You know, I'm all right. I hope you're all right. And, you know, I'm just like, it's been kind of a mind-blowing week and a half doing this movie. I'm realizing that independent filmmaking has its own sort of compulsion, like, you know, the challenge on everybody's part to sort of, you know, make the day, economize, make kind of compromises, but, you know, figuring out how to get what you need, that there's something intrinsically exciting about that. Because you hear about these movies that have hundreds of millions of dollars, and those sound like a disaster. Here, you're kind of working, you know, kind of, you know, very economically and very precisely, and you're moving quick, that it's got its own charm. You know, I'm sure I'm not, you know, saying, not surprising anybody involved in the pursuit of making independent film, but it's been sort of exciting to be part of the process of sort of like, we got to do it, we got to get it. And, you know, one or two takes, man. But everything's okay. There's been a weird swirl of events going on around me in terms of sobriety, in terms of, you know, people reaching out and my own reactions to those people. And then I guess I could be more specific. I get a lot of emails from people, and I got a disturbing email from someone who, like, as you know, that I generally try to get back to people if they are struggling with, you know, addiction or alcoholism, and share my experience a little bit, or give, you know, some sort of, you know, kind of support. And, you know, I got a disturbing email from somebody who I don't really know, that, you know, was suicidal and been in the sort of throes of, you know, alcoholic kind of self-pity and pain. And, you know, I had a reaction to that where I'm like, oh, come on, man. And, you know, then I check back. You know, apparently he's okay. You know, he made it through, but I hope he gets it. And then, like, some other people in my life are struggling with, you know, codependency, and that, like, it just kind of swirls around all at once to make me realize, hey, man, I guess not that I'm a spiritual guy or a God person, but, you know, sometimes, you know, I go mystical occasionally. Maybe it's time to sort of recommit, read a little literature, because I'm trying to help somebody else. So I'm reading my literature, and I'm like, wow, I did a lot of underlining over 20 years of having this book in my bag. And I was like, wow, this stuff is pretty relative. Like, this part, like, might help me. Why am I not doing this? It's right here, and I've done it before, and it says to do it, and I'll feel better. Why am I not doing that? I don't know. Because it's too much effort. Is it 10 minutes at the end of a day? It's weird how stubborn we are in our own patterns. This is not a self-help podcast, but, man, like, I am so ready to get out of some of them. I am so ready. And thank God I've got the equipment and the tools and the clarity of mind to do it. That's all. Some sort of weird collective, you know, the serendipity kind of surrounded me. Coincidences transcended coincidence to congeal into some meaning for me around, like, hey, time to sort of do some work, pal. You want to break through to the next thing so you can settle into your body a little more? Well, get the book out, stupid. Yeah, that's how I read it. But I hope you're all okay out there. I hopefully will be back in L.A. For next week's shows. If everything works out right, we got 2 days of shooting. I got to get ready to go do that. And right now, I want to share with you this interview that I did with Brent Butt. You can subscribe to his YouTube channel, The Butt Pod. Also find him on Twitter, Instagram, and at BrentButt.com. Had a show up here for years that is now, you know, in animated form, called Corner Gas. He's sort of, like I said before, kind of a Canadian comedy star and a good guy. And I've run into him over the years at different festivals, and I was happy to chat with him. So this is me talking to Brent Butt. It's weird because I had a friend in high school named Alan Butt, and I keep wanting to say Alan because it's memorable when someone's last name is Butt. Anyways, Brent Butt.
I don't think you can lump us all together.
I'm not trying
in
to.
One kind I'm not. Of. I mean, there are. I know there are only like 50 of us.
Well,
in the second biggest country in the world. It's about 102 Canadians.
Yeah, you got you in Australia. You got lucky with the territory.
Yeah.
You got plenty of room to do whatever the fuck you want.
I don't know what the hell, why we, you know, you think, geez, we got the second biggest country.
Right.
How?
Yeah.
And then come do February, you realize why.
Why it's so.
Everybody wasn't lined up for it.
Do you know, well, I don't want to lump Canadians together, and I don't, because I know there's a tremendous diversity of people up there. You know, a lot of Asians, a lot of indigenous people, French Canadians, you know, who, you know, come from sort of pirate stock.
I'm learning about Canada.
Trappers.
Pirate stock.
No, trappers.
Yeah, the voyageurs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aren't they?
They were.
So I wasn't off. I don't know if
pirates and trappers are similar.
Well, no, but you know, the personality, you just figure they're like, hey, here we go, let's go kill something. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I don't. I
have friends who have a trap. I shouldn't say friends, but guys that I knew growing up in my hometown. I grew up in this little town in northern Saskatchewan. I was back there, and I ran into one of the guys, and I was like, hey, what's going on? What are you up to? And he goes, oh, I was just with my buddy, and we got a trap line.
What are they trapping?
Well, I guess we're done talking. I don't know what else to say. Guy's got a, you know, 21st century. He's out trapping animals.
Well, I mean, it's a tradition. I mean, sometimes, you know, traditions die hard, right? Maybe he comes from trappers.
He does not.
Oh, it's just something.
I think he wants to torture and kill animals. That's what I think it is.
It's not for their pelts or for their meat. Is he trapping rabbits? What are we talking? I don't know.
I literally walked away.
Oh, really?
I literally was like, hey, cool to see you. We're done talking.
But
I strolled away.
But there are hunters up there. Do you judge hunters with the same?
No, I feel, I just did not expect to hear.
Trappers.
I think there's a different level of cruelty to trapping.
No doubt. I mean, anything that the animal has to chew its limb off to escape is cruelty. It shouldn't be alive to do that.
Like somebody who shoots another person, like an execution style killer, that's bad, right?
Yeah, right.
But somebody who keeps you around and gives you acid baths or whatever, takes your fingers one at a
time.
Horrible. That's a different level.
Give me the execution guy every time. or at least let me run. And you hunt me down. That's a sportsman's way to do it. That's a sportsman's way to do it.
If you gave me the option of, listen, you can run, I'd stop you right there. No, I'm not going to run. Just kill me now.
Yeah, okay.
Why am I going to die winded?
Winded, and I have no survival skills. I'll be out there.
I'm quick to quit.
Yeah.
That's what I've learned. Like anytime, you know that never,
yeah,
failure is not an option?
Sure,
I always think it's like,
yeah,
it's really plan.
Yeah. Plan A. B. A, right. A. Yeah. No, failure, it's always what I assume is going to happen.
Yeah, it's a high probability.
Sure. So when it doesn't happen, it's like, wow, I got away with it.
Yeah. That's kind of how I feel about my whole life.
Yeah, me too, dude.
I'm like, holy hell, how did this happen?
You're telling me, man. You're telling me. So wait, okay, now let's go back to this generalizing.
Let's go
Canadians.
Back to the voyageurs.
Yeah. Because you... Well, see, I don't know. Like, I get people who are like, a lot of people don't think necessarily the Canadians are that different, or it's another country, but it's a whole other country, a whole other history, and I don't fucking know it. I had Charlie Demers in here, and I'm learning about a lot of things.
Well, he's going to teach you a lot more about stuff than I will. I'm glad you learned stuff from him.
I'm not asking you about socialism and the future of the planet.
I have one Canadian joke. I only ever heard, you know how there's like jokes of different cultures and stuff? I've only ever heard one Canadian joke, but I love it.
What?
Have you ever heard a Canadian joke?
Let's hear it. Other than Mike Wilmot?
That guy's the best.
He is.
I love that guy.
He is.
I had him on my show playing Cousin Carl. I'll tell you that story.
We're going to work up to that.
The only Canadian joke I've heard. How do you get 110 Canadians out of a swimming pool?
How?
You say, okay, everybody, time to get out of the pool.
No crying kids. No one waiting back.
No, just all right.
Okay.
It's time, I guess. Fella wants us out of the pool.
Well, that's all, but you are, there is a general politeness, if not mundanity.
Jesus, I never even heard that word. Is that actually a word? Because you can make words up, but I won't catch you.
I think it is. Let's try. Let's see if it fits.
Mundanity?
Is it? Yeah, I think so. I'm not great with them. I throw them around sometimes.
That sounds like more like an insult, like kind of, you come in here with, do you have the mundanity to declare?
No. It's the conditioner quality of being mundane.
I think there is a general notion, and probably not inaccurate, that we're a little boring. In terms of, you know, people on the globe, Canadians are pretty, we're pretty boring.
Yeah, but there's a lot of funny people up there, and I found the, like, but it's relative to the culture, right? I used to think it was boring, and the reason is you don't have people shooting everybody everywhere.
Yeah.
There's not, you know, insane sort of, I think, the what is socialized up there has sort of tempered the competitive nature of the capitalism up there, so people aren't fucking, you know.
It's not unregulated capitalism.
Right.
Like,
right.
I figure I'm a capitalist. I love to make a buck. I love to, ever since I was a little kid, I would try and sell stuff, and, you know, I would... I would draw cartoons and try and sell them to my siblings. And they're like, why the hell would I buy your goddamn cartoons? But I was always into like trying to make a buck.
You could just take it from your room. I don't need
But the notion of unregulated capitalism seems weird to me. I'm weird. For regulation.
Weird? Here's what it looks like. It looks like America right now. This is the end game of unregulated capitalism.
But you know, here's the thing about like when you wander around America.
Yeah.
Maybe I just, you know, I don't wander around a lot of America.
Yeah.
Maybe I have a privileged
big
view.
Sure.
But, you know, things are going about. It's not dystopian. There's not, you know, roving bands of marauders.
Well, you're not going to the right areas.
Yeah, that's true.
You got to go to the dystopian areas.
It's my mundanity that keeps me from seeking the adventure.
But is there a way to, okay, so we've kind of generalized Canadians, but all the Canadians I've met are different. They're like, and there's a lot of funny people that come out of there. Who did I just interview? I've only got one more kid in the hall to interview. I interviewed Bruce.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago.
He's a funny dude.
He is.
And a different way of funny. He's got a very original brain.
Oh, yeah. Original brain, sort of his own time zone, that guy.
Like, yeah.
You're operating, you know, Mike McDonald, before he passed, I had him. At that point, he was a little slower because he was sick.
Yeah.
But, you know, funny. Howie, I did. Mike Myers, he's an animated guy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just naming Canadians.
It's like when you have a black friend and you start saying, you know, all the black people you've met before. Yeah. It's like that with Canadians. Listen, some of my friends are Canadian.
Yeah, a few of them. Yeah. But where did you grow up in this rural?
I grew up in the, it's called Northern Saskatchewan, but it's really, if you look at Saskatchewan.
I have no idea. Is that west, east, middle?
Right in the middle. It's above. Like
Winnipeg?
North Dakota and Montana.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Straight up.
Straight up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's boring in terms of geography.
Yeah.
There's nothing there.
In fact,
the borders, there's, you know, generally borders between states or provinces or whatever are defined by some river or a mountain.
Yeah.
These are just two straight lines.
Is there a sign?
Well, here, I guess. We'll draw the lines here.
Is there a sign?
For Saskatchewan? Yeah,
you crossed over.
Congratulations, you're in Saskatchewan. So it's like it's you know, it's bigger than Texas, but it has less than 1 million people there.
It's huge.
Right around 1 million people.
Right. And what do you say? There's nothing out there?
Farmland.
It's farmland. It's not tundra. It's workable land.
This is why. So it's like a big rectangle.
Yeah.
The northern half is just bush, and there's like 15 people living in the northern half of Saskatchewan. And then the bottom half is just flat farmland. And so all the, you know, 98% of the population of Saskatchewan is, Kevin Rooney one time said.
Have you talked to him lately?
He said, not in a long time, no, but he always busted me up.
Yeah.
But he said there was all these people. It's a pie crust of Canadians huddled along the warmth of the American border. And that's kind of what it is. So I lived in what they call Northern Saskatchewan. That's where I grew up. But it was the northern half of the southern populated portion.
Okay. So you're just at the edge of it. You could look out and see like there's nothing.
Yeah. And that was another thing he was talking about. He was like, where you grew up, he said to me, as a kid.
Yeah.
When you go to bed at night, are you just staring out the window wondering what kind of frost monster is going to crawl down from the top of the world and eat you in your sleep? And I was like, that's such a great Rooney sentence.
Yeah. You know? But it's also, were you?
Not at all. You don't know anything. But I mean, it's very, you know, there's like one person for every 5 square miles.
Well, what are we talking? Let's generalize some more. Are these hill people? Are they decent people? Are they scary people? Are they people that you see and you wave from a distance and go, what the fuck's that guy up to?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't run into a lot of people.
Yeah.
So there's a wariness.
Yeah.
Right?
But it's not
you're
dangerous.
Like, holy God, there's another person.
Yeah. Do you come from farmers?
Yeah, I was a townie. Like my parents were both farm people, and for the first three kids, like I'm the seventh kid. I'm the youngest of seven.
Holy shit! How Catholic are you?
We weren't at all. It was
really
just cold and nothing to do, I guess.
Let's have another one. Yeah, and no birth control up north.
No, I'm sure that. In fact, my mother, I remember when, I'm sure the last five of us were accidents, right? You don't, they had no money. Yeah, why do you want more kids?
Yeah.
I remember saying to my mom, or she's saying to me, we were watching some made for TV movie.
Yeah.
I was home visiting her one time when I was, I think I was maybe 40 at this time.
It's good you weren't living with her.
No, so back home visiting her, and she was watching some cheesy, like, made-for-TV movie. And at the act break, before they go to commercial, the woman finds out, the star of the movie finds out she's pregnant. She doesn't want to be. Oh, no, that's the go to commercial. And so my mother says, she says, yeah, I remember, you know, when I found out I was pregnant with you, I looked up to God and I said, why? Can you imagine? I said, Mom, you're not supposed to tell the kid that. And she goes, what are you, 40? Did you not feel loved? She was like a real hard ass, hard farm woman, had no time for. She was, oh, did you not feel loved?
How old was she at the time?
76. She was 36 when I was born. Fuck, you made me do math.
I'm sorry. But it's weird, though, because there is, it doesn't seem to be, the statute of limitations on what you can tell your children about things they shouldn't know about runs out somewhere in the 70s. It starts coming out in the 70s where they're like, I didn't know how to love you when you were a child. Wait, what? What? Wait a minute.
Why? I didn't even know if I was going to.
Yeah.
Or if I'd be able to.
Yeah, it's like, well, that answers a lot of questions for me. So you were the last one?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I was 7 of 7.
Do you know all the other ones?
Yeah, I can rattle off their names. Elna, Elmer, Velma, John, Della, Lloyd, and Brent. That's the thing. It's this weird hodgepodge of names, like a lot of unusual names. Elna, Elmer, Velma. That's the first three.
Elna. I know one other Elna.
Elna, Elmer, Velma. Then John.
Yeah.
Like shifting gears.
Yeah, yeah.
And then back to Della after that, and then Lloyd and Brent.
Are these family names?
I don't know. Like I asked
Velma?
I know Elmer, I believe.
Your brother.
This story. The oldest boy in the family, Elmer, was named after my dad fought in World War II, and he had a buddy there, and his name was Elmer or something.
That's
I think
pretty
that's
good name.
Yeah, solid.
I mean,
name.
It's like a, yeah, it's like it's a classic.
Especially if your last name is Butt, then it's very Elmer Fudd close. Elmer Butt.
Elmer Butt. But like, it's like one of those names where it's like, it was kind of like a working class name. I don't know when, but you don't hear it anymore at all.
Yeah.
Elmer. Is he still around?
Yeah.
Oh, everyone's still with us?
Yeah, all my siblings are still with
us. That's great.
There was an eighth who died in infancy somewhere in the middle there between us.
Oh, really?
Wayne.
Yeah. Oh,
so
Wayne.
There would have been eight, but he was a matter of, I think, a month old.
So your mom was tough.
Yeah.
Was she like, where did
just
she come from? Was she
Canadian? Depression era hard farm woman.
But all, really? But all from Canada for generations.
Yeah, although her she was born in Canada, but her family came from Nebraska.
Scandinavians?
I always said they moved from Nebraska to Saskatchewan because they wanted to gear down. They couldn't handle the hurly-burly pace of Ponca, Nebraska, so they came to Saskatchewan.
It was probably for more land.
Well, it was. Saskatchewan, was they were trying to populate,
right?
And so they were giving away very
inexpensive
land.
Were they Scandinavian? You don't know.
No. Irish would be her heritage, and my father's heritage was English. But
how'd they get to Canada? Why Canada?
Well, with my mother's
Nebraska,
parents, like it was the land giveaway.
Yeah,
they could literally get three. They sold their farm in Nebraska and got like three times as much land. Or something,
right. Four sure. That's how. Land. That's how they did it here too. They had all these. I think they were like Siberian or Scandinavian. Like no one knew how to farm that land up there. So they gave away the land to people from countries that had the type
similar.
Of weather.
Yeah.
And you know that's why you
There's
get all
a lot
those...
of Ukrainians came to Saskatchewan.
Oh yeah.
Because it was very similar on the same
winter
what do you call
wheat
it, a parallel or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so a lot. I was the only of my buddies growing up. They were almost all Ukrainian stock.
Oh yeah.
I was the. I always said I was the visible minority because my shirt wasn't buttoned crooked. was my anti-Ukrainian joke
it's
to my friends
good.
Growing up.
Yeah, knocking that community, the Ukrainians. They don't
but
get
I
enough
was,
shit.
I was the minority.
Yeah.
You got to understand.
Yeah.
I was free
Did you
to
get
lash
to eat at their house a lot? Like pierogies?
Yeah.
And
unbelievable
like,
food.
Good
so
food,
great.
Right?
And then I was always like a little fat kid, and their parents would always say I was too skinny. I loved that. They'd be like, eat some more, have some more sausage, you're too skinny.
Well, what were they farming, man? What do you know?
Changes by... the market you
oh,
know
yeah.
whatever but there was a ton of wheat
yeah.
a ton of canola or rapeseed. My hometown Tisdale, Saskatchewan had this they just changed it as of a couple of years
yeah.
ago but for 50 years or something they had this town motto was the land of rape and honey
yeah.
and so it was kind of this controversial thing and got them a lot of attention because they grew rapeseed and there were a lot of apiaries there so it was the land of rape and honey. And there was some heavy metal band that called their album The Land of Rape and Honey after seeing that on like a coffee
yeah,
mug.
Sure. Why wouldn't you? I'd like one of those mugs. So they changed it, I guess?
Yeah.
I'm assuming?
Yeah, to something very mundanity.
Yeah. Mundane.
Something. It's like the
something
where opportunity grows or something like that. Something very.
Still a lot of bees up there?
I offered up my suggestion was, welcome to Tisdale, Saskatchewan, home of the pointless fist fight. That was my, yeah. They didn't think it would be good.
Still a lot of bees up there?
Yeah, still a lot of bees. That was like all my life. I think actually the year that I was born, my father took a job at the honey plant where they processed honey, and he ran the boiler rooms and stuff there.
Yeah. So you had plenty of honey growing up?
Yeah, loads of honey.
Like the raw stuff in the cone?
Still when I smell honey, like if you're in a store and there's like a beeswax candle, and it smells like my dad.
Really?
I launch back. It reminds me of my dad.
That's crazy. That's a unique and singular sense memory.
Yeah, it is. And it's so locked in. Like it's so tied to your olfactory senses and your memory.
And that smell, beeswax.
Beeswax smells like my dad. And he was just, you know, he just was a scrappy...
Didn't have anything invested in honey, necessarily. It's just a job.
He went to work.
Yeah. But he...
ran the boiler room. I don't know what the hell they needed boilers for.
To get the wax. That's how they separated shit, right? They had to separate the wax from the honey.
And there was just bees, like, just all around the factory. I remember... I have this very clear memory one time, because I used to go with them sometime to work.
Of course.
And hang out in the summer, you know, the summer holidays, home from school. Because the boiler room was very... It seemed like the Bat Cave to me, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
One wall of it was just, like, dirt. It was, like, carved out of dirt. And then there was, like... you know, pipes and everything, like a mad scientist kind of, like a bat cave. And so I used to like to go hang out there, and I have this clear memory of one time he was he was telling me something, and as he was talking, he was going to put on, you know, he's putting on these big rubber gloves that he used to handle these hot barrels or whatever. So he's talking to me, puts on these gloves, and then he takes the glove off. He doesn't even lose a sentence. And about 9 bees fly out of this glove. And he never even stopped talking. And I said to him, didn't you get stung there? He said, oh, yeah, I got stung a lot then. But it was just like part of the day.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I get stung 50 times a day.
Work hazard. So the bees are just there because it smells so good.
They love the way my dad smelled.
Yeah. And to this day, many bees, when they smell that, they think of your father.
Think of my father. Remember that, dude? But yeah, there was no room for, so, you know, depression era, you know, my dad fought Nazis and the whole thing.
Did
and
he?
He was fought in World War II, and my mom was depression era farm woman. So there was no room for complaining growing up.
Right. That's probably good.
You know, you could grouse a little, get your point across, but I don't want to hear you complaining about a bunch
of stuff. So you went ahead and made a career out of it. You found your voice.
I don't even, like, my comedy is very... It doesn't even come from a place of complaining, comedy does.
Yeah, it's observational.
Know? Yeah, and it's really kind of, it comes from a place of, here's what I don't get.
Right.
It's legitimately, I'm puzzled by things.
Right. So how does that, so you're the runt of this litter, and did you learn a lot from your brothers? Were you wearing everyone else's clothes? How did that work?
Yeah, all that stuff. Because we didn't have any money growing up. I don't know how much my dad was making. What he was hauling down net for running the
but you had
boiler rooms, and
everybody got taken care of.
Yeah,
that's a lot of kids. You don't have 7 kids without health care.
So there's a lot of there was a lot of hand-me-downs.
Yeah,
and then my mother worked at the local thrift store, right? So people would donate their clothes, and then sometimes she would bring clothes. Something would be like, "This would fit you," and I'd be like, I'm going to go to school. That was always my fear. It was like I was going to go to school and some kid would be like, God damn, that's my shirt, man.
That's the one we threw away.
Yeah.
I got a new one.
Now you're wearing it. that puts you in the state of like, where you're verbally, you got to verbally be able to lash back at anybody who's going to make fun of you.
Right.
And I think that's a good background for developing comedy.
Oh, absolutely. Guarded defensiveness.
But the whole thing around
preemptive strike.
We were all trying to make each other laugh growing up. That was their thing.
What'd your siblings end up doing? Are they teachers and
very different things? Elmer
with the good name.
Elmer with the good name. Yeah, that's a Jay-Z song, isn't it? Beyonce song. he fixes and watches and clocks, and he's one of the few people that knows how to, because he's kind of self-taught, and he's done this his whole adult life. People send him antique clocks from all over the place because he's the only dude who knows how to take apart a clock, figure, it doesn't matter what the mechanism is, he takes it apart, figures out how it's supposed to work, what's wrong.
So he's like a very specialized person. Like, does he do museum pieces and stuff, and they send, like, is he world renowned?
The premier of the province of Saskatchewan called him to come fix the clock that the province of Quebec had given to Saskatchewan as a gift in 1906 or something.
And was this something like you see him around when you were a kid? Did you see him taking things apart?
Yeah.
Oh, that was his.
And apparently my parents always said with him,
yeah,
from the time he was a kid, if you gave him a little toy, just take it apart.
Yeah.
That was his first thing he'd do. He didn't want to play with it. Take it apart, see how the hell it worked. It's, I have none of that. We're all very different, I think, my siblings.
Yeah.
I have no curiosity or understanding of how anything works. Don't want to know.
How's he with cars?
Yeah, he's awesome with cars.
Really?
Two of my brothers are great with cars.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then me and another one of my brothers were like into writing and language, and yeah, I play music. And we,
yeah,
but we're all kind of an offspring of, you know, my father was like that. He was like the toughest dude you ever met.
Yeah.
But he also wrote poetry and played music.
Yeah.
And he was this really diverse,
eclectic,
you know,
cat.
Eclectic dude, yeah.
Renaissance man.
Yeah, he really was.
And your mom.
So he like built our house with his bare hands.
Oh, he did?
You know, I don't know how. The only thing he wouldn't do is electrical. Because he said, that shit would kill you.
Yeah,
you imagine, there's no wiggle room there with that. Plumbing, things get wet if you mess up. But, you know, like electricity, you're done. Hire a pro for that.
He's right.
Yeah, yeah. He was a wise man.
And your mom just, what'd she do?
She raised the kids.
That's a lot.
You know, that's full-time.
Was it like one every year? What are the?
You know, like every 2 or 3 years. There's seven of us spread out over 16 years. Between the oldest and myself, there's 16 years.
Oh. So how do you, like from that world, how do you, like, because the comedy world in Canada, I know a lot of the guys and I know how it's kind of set up, but how do you start doing that? I mean, were you doing another job first?
My only real path in life was to do stand-up. It was the only thing that I was interested in doing. It's the only thing that made sense to me outside of, you know, I had a dream of playing in the NHL, being a goalie in the NHL, but that was kind of a pipe dream.
The hockey dream. That's every Canadian kid's dream.
Yeah.
Right?
And I knew, I was wise enough to know early on, this is not going to, I don't have the skill set.
Right.
But the only other thing, when I was 12, there used to be this talk show, afternoon talk show that was videotaped live in Vancouver 5 days a week.
Yeah.
This guy, Alan Hamill, was the host of the show. He ended up marrying Suzanne Summers, and he left the show to go be her manager. And it was taken over by Alan Thick, became the host of this afternoon talk show in Vancouver.
He became sort of big here.
And they had, the thick of the night. Remember, he had a nighttime talk show?
I don't think it lasted that long. And I think his son just had to pay the estate of Marvin Gaye a lot.
Yeah, Nancy and I were just talking about that last night. But anyway, this afternoon talk show had maybe 2 or 3 days out of the week, they would have a stand-up comedian on it. And that was the first time, and I remember the first time I ever saw a stand-up comedian.
We're like the same age. So you're talking, how old were you?
I was 12.
So it was like 1978, something like that. Yeah.
And Kelly Monteith was the guy.
Kelly Monteith.
Yeah.
Monteith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd never seen sketch comedy, sitcoms, and guys being funny.
Yeah.
But just somebody walking out and standing there and talking, and not really doing, he wasn't like doing knock-knock jokes or something. He was just a guy talking about stuff and being hilarious.
I know, it's a great moment,
isn't it? And it just changed my world. I was like, holy, that's an option?
Yeah.
Because that's what I do with my buddies now while we're waiting to get into the school. And So
I'm trying to remember what he looks like. He was like, he's an American guy, isn't he?
Yeah, an American guy. And then he had big success over in Britain for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the first dude that I saw, and I became obsessed. So every afternoon, when I was home from school in the summer, the first thing, I would always make sure I was home at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, because they would say at the start of the show whether they have a comedian on or not.
Right.
If they didn't, I'd bugger off and go play with my buddies. If they did, I'd be like, I'll be out in an hour. That became my path. It was
Who else did you think was great? Because were there Canadian comics at that time?
Yeah. So a lot of the guys were Toronto Yuck Yucks comedians, like Mike McDonald. That's where I
already
first saw Mike McDonald.
Right, so this is the late 70s?
Larry Horowitz.
Late 70s?
Yeah. Yeah, so all those guys, you know, Lawrence Morgenstern. And it's also the first place I saw Richard Lewis. I remember, because he was like nobody else I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
He was just all over the map, and Alan Thick didn't know what to make of him. But he was cracking everybody up.
Yeah.
And I was so enamored by this. Nothing seemed scripted with him. He was just like pulling ideas out of the air. He was so manic. And I remember after the show was over, going out to meet my buddies to play baseball or whatever the hell we were doing. I was trying to trying to do his stuff to them, and none of it made sense.
Holding your head, wandered pacing around. Yeah. Yeah, he still works that way.
Yeah.
He definitely is out there on the wire.
That was my window to stand up. And then I did it for the first time in high school, like at a variety night, drama night, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I offered up doing stand up, and that was weird to them. They were like, "What do you mean?" And so
did you do it?
Yeah, and it went well. Encouraged me. I did it the next year, and that kind of gave me the notion that maybe I can do this. And
so then, that was your only job? You never tried anything else?
No, because I was like 17 then.
Right.
And there weren't. When I was 21, there was a club that opened up in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which is 2 hours away, and I moved there to start it. But yeah, between leaving high school, like I knew I wasn't going to go to college or anything. So I worked as a drywaller. I worked as an illustrator and cartoonist for the local newspaper and another newspaper nearby.
Yeah, you still draw?
Yeah.
Huh. You still do cartoons?
Yeah.
Really? You sell them?
We're doing, in a weird way, I guess, because Corner Gas, the TV show that I did, we're now doing the animated version. We're in season 2 of the animated version. So when I left high school,
getting a lot of mileage out of Corner Gas.
Holy man, it's the I'm the new Gilligan. I'm like the Canadian Gilligan. I'm gonna be opening boat shows and stuff. But yeah, we're doing the animated version now. Listen, when somebody comes to you and says, "Hey, do you want to continue making a living?"
Well, I mean, okay, so you start out and you're at that club in Saskatoon.
Yeah, that's where I first started.
So, like, you got a local crew there, and then you got the Canadian dudes that come through, but it's not a Breslin club, right?
Yeah, it was. It was one of the,
Because, like, no one works without his, you've got to be knighted by Mark Breslin.
Yeah, at the time, that's how it was.
I feel like he emailed me, or somebody did. But whatever, I know he runs Canada. Like, he's the guy that runs comedy in the entire country, basically.
Ran. Yeah.
No more.
It's not that way anymore, no.
Oh.
But it was that way, for sure.
For years, right?
The notion that you could, it was very propagandized to the comedians, too. It was like, you can't make a living outside of, you have to do whatever we say because you can't possibly make a living
outside of yucks.
And after about four and a half years of me working with Yucks, I'd kind of had enough. There was me and a group of another, like 12 comedians we all left at once, basically. And so you have that fear of like, oh my God, am I ever going to be able to make a buck? And within a week, this is God's honest truth, within a week of me leaving Yucks, I was booked on A&E's Comedy on the Road, and I had HBO phone me at home to come do their young comedians audition for the Young Comedians special.
Yeah.
And both conversations started with, is it true that you have nothing to do with Yuck Yucks anymore?
Why? Because
it was like I was on their radar, but if it's going to be, if I got to deal with Yucks, I'm not going to bother.
Well, so tell me about that, because like that's not really something that ever really happened here. There was like, here it was more of a tradition. I mean, the improvs became a chain, but from my recollection and not necessarily from my experience, outside of Catch a Rising Star and the improvs, which came later, the club owner was a very specific type.
Yeah.
And you had to deal with each one independently.
Yeah.
Some you had to party with, some you had to be nice to, some you had to listen
to. Those were the ones I could never get on. The ones that wanted to pay you in coke.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm really into paying my rent.
They got a few guys. You know who the guys are, who got paid in coke. But so you're starting in Saskatoon. You're doing, they have an open mic?
Yeah. Thursday night. It was the first night in February 1988. I remember the...
And then you stay in that area and you're kind of, building your act.
For a matter of months.
Building the act.
Yeah. So I was going down an amateur night and... it was going well.
Yeah.
So I got offered a couple weekend spots, paid spots.
Uh-huh.
And then they were like, hey, there's this guy coming through, John Wing Jr., who I'd seen on TV.
I know Wing.
Yeah,
I saw him
do a
Canadian night at the Comedy Store.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Was it like Canada Day, July 1st?
I think it might have been. So Wing,
they said, this guy's coming through, and we need an opening act for him. He's going to go do a show at Diggers in Prince Albert.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, goddamn, I'll
Digger.
Do it.
So there were independent clubs at that time. There were independent clubs at that time outside of the Yucks.
Well, it was like a one-nighter that was booked through Yucks, right? So if you were the headliner that was coming in to play that club.
He really had it under wraps. So
he had
the clubs and he had the fucking one-nighters out in the boonies, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he'd book a night at a bar or a hall, and it would be a weekly gig. It was a one-nighter. but it was still Breslin.
Yeah.
God,
so you would, you know, you're booked to play the club Friday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, let's say, and then maybe, you know, the Tuesday, Wednesday before that, you'd come into town, you'd do
you'd go drive out to North Battleford
and Prince Albert, you'd do these little towns.
All Breslin gigs.
Yeah.
So the payoff was you could do the club.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you do this, you can open at the club too.
Yeah.
Right. But so what? So there were just no other options, and no one would try to start clubs outside of Breslin?
Yeah, people would try to start clubs.
Yeah, and then he forbid you
from
working.
Let's put it this way. This is all for legal reasons. This is my recollection of how it went down.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
Does that cover me legally?
Sure.
This is my
This is also the no one gives a shit anymore clause.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, as I recall... You were basically told that you can't work for anybody that, you know.
Yeah.
That was the one place that would book you. So other people would try to start comedy clubs, but they had very limited access to talent.
To Canadian talent.
Yeah.
Because local talent. Right. So because you're.
And then even out of towners, like if somebody like yourself wanted to come through and play that club, you would. The notion was, as I recall, you would be forbidden from playing Yucks, and that was the big chain. So you don't want to piss off the big chain, so you could play one.
Right, but I think as a testament to the good thing that Breslin did was he was pretty loyal to Canadian comics. I mean, it wasn't easy for American acts to do Yucks, for a while, right? I mean, it was mostly Canadian acts, no?
Yeah, but I don't know how much the loyalty plays into that as opposed to grabbing, here's some schnooks off the street who'll work for a soda.
I guess so, but he did give you the stages.
Yeah, so it's one of those things, you know, it's like, yeah.
Like, how long did the Iron Fist of Breslin...
Well, if Yuck started in the 70s, and then so early 90s, I was living in Toronto by this time, Toronto comic, right?
Yeah.
Because I started in Saskatoon, but within months I'd moved to Calgary, which was the kind of booking center for Western Canada. And then I was there for months. And then another comedian by the name of Jamie Davis just called me up out of the blue. I barely knew him. I'd met him once at a comedy competition. He said, listen, I'm going to Toronto. You should hop in my car and come with me because you should be seen by the people who booked the clubs out there.
Laugh Resort?
No, this was pre-Laugh Resort.
Uh-huh.
So I went out to Toronto. So I was living in Toronto. Long story short, I worked in the Yucks organization for about 4 years and then kind of had it.
There were other clubs in Toronto.
Yeah, so there was, at the time, myself and 12 other comedians said, we're leaving all at once.
Right.
And there was another club that had started up a little before that called the Laugh Resort. And now suddenly they had the talent pool that they had previously, as well as this new talent pool of 12 other comics that they didn't have access to before. And it gave them enough of a talent pool to maintain an existence. And that was the beginning of the loosening of the iron glove.
Of the iron, the fist of Breslin. The Breslin iron fist of funny. Yeah, I didn't work Yucks forever. I mean, I'd go up and do Montreal and do the Jimmies and go to these festivals. And I did the Laugh Resort. But I didn't work a Yuck Yucks forever until like not too long ago. I did that downtown one. And I don't even remember what town. Was it was it Toronto?
Toronto, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, like I said, I haven't played. I haven't been within that organization since the early 90s. So I don't even really know how it works anymore.
Oh, so you're out.
Yeah, I mean, from the time I left.
He wouldn't put you back, not even now, as big an act as you are? He wouldn't.
Oh, no, for sure. I would always get, like other headline comics that played his club would always come to me and go, listen, I think I could get you back into the market. I'd be like, why the hell am I want to? I'm playing theaters.
Why would I go back there? But the theater shift came after the show, I imagine.
Yeah.
Well, so how did...
So there was other independent clubs, Rumors in Winnipeg and Laugh Resort. And, there were clubs and you could go around and make a
Rumors list. Is still around, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's a good club.
Is it? I've done the Winnipeg Comedy Festival, and that was the only time I was in
Rumors
Winnipeg.
Is a great club. It's kind of everything you want in a comedy club. It's that basement, low ceiling, fantastic sight lines, no pillars. It's like kind of an ideal.
Really?
With the back of the room is tiered up, on that second level. So, and it seats like whatever, 275 or 300 people or something. So it's really fantastic setup.
I think the last time I saw you actually, maybe not. We played a curling rink.
That's exactly right.
And that was the gala.
In Victoria. The Blue Bridge Comedy Festival. Yeah, that was the big show because you could pack a lot of people in the curling rink. That festival, yeah, that still goes on.
I think that was like, didn't we do like the first one?
I think it might have been.
And but the curling rink was terrible. I was watching. Yeah,
well, it was very echoey, right?
Yeah, you couldn't hear. You couldn't time yourself. I was watching other people, and but they'd say something on the stage. Like 3 seconds later, you'd hear it in the back, and then it would bounce off the fucking concrete.
It's just not a good setup.
Are they still playing?
If there's any comedy bookers out there, curling arenas
not great.
Not great.
Are they still using that for the gala?
I don't know.
Yeah, I would hope not.
I couldn't say.
It was one of the worst memories of my life.
But you did well.
I do not remember doing well.
Yeah, because you couldn't hear their laughter the same way you can't hear your own voice.
Couldn't hear anything. Everything was happening a second or two after it happened.
Yeah, it is very kind of surreal. And so you got to disjoint yourself from what you're saying and what you're hearing.
Yeah.
You've got to be two different
things. Great, that's a whole other skill I need to... Yeah, that's what I got to... If you're playing a
curling
rink... If you
want to work, Victoria, my friend.
I just remember seeing you and we had a long conversation about the Cheetos type of snack.
Oh, yeah, Cheesies. Hawkins Cheesies.
Hawkins Cheesies.
They're in my rider. They're when I travel. Hawkins Cheesies.
Yeah, you schooled me on Hawkins Cheesies.
Because they're a hard, crunchy...
They're
cornmeal based.
Yeah, they're very good. This is exactly the pitch you gave me. Go on.
They're made with real Canadian cheddar. Yeah. No, like some, not like some kind of weird chemical cheese.
Yeah.
Very high level of sodium.
Yeah, yeah.
Like
I think it's the crunchy thing. They're like more satisfying Cheetos because you can taste that they're real cheese and it's real cornmeal.
It's real cornmeal. It's very crunchy.
Yeah, you had me going on them. Like I was, and I'm not even that kind of.
As a good guest, I should have thought to bring some down for you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even a bag snack kind of guy. I'm not a chips.
What I recall of that situation was you were very begrudgingly. You didn't want to like the cheesies. You didn't want to like the Canadian snack. You were like, I don't know about this.
Yeah.
And then you could see the resolve in your face dwindling with each morsel you bit. You were like, finally, like, God damn, these are pretty good. I got to say.
Yeah, man.
You didn't want to like the Canadian snack.
So, okay. So you leave Breslin, then you come down here and you didn't get the HBO Young Comedians, but you did do comedy on the road with who? Biner? Who was hosting?
Yeah, John Biner. And I ended up later touring with John Biner.
In Canada?
Yeah, he came through. Actually, the guy who owned Rumors Comedy Club, he's since passed away now, but he put together this show that was three Canadian comedians opening for John Biner.
Yeah.
Well, John Biner worked as the host, really, what
sure,
it was.
And that's then he probably would put the these best. Three. Yeah.
And he just took a bath on the tour, I remember.
No one cared about John Biner?
Well, it was like, it wasn't that... I said to him on the tour, I said, I don't know who the hell you kind of think we are here.
Who was it?
Like, it was me and John Rogers me and John Rogers. And
I don't remember anything about it other than like, why is this
and
guy?
And Derek Edwards was the other guy on the tour. Do you ever see him? He's a Canadian dude who never ventured down here, really.
I don't know if I've seen
him. But he's maybe... the funniest dude walking the planet. Derek Edwards.
Let me go. I gotta.
He's
look
one
at
of those guys. I remember when I did A&E's Comedy on the Road.
Yeah.
That same year, he was on another. You know, they would take multiple nights.
Yeah.
And so he was on it, and you could see all the U.S. managers snap to attention when Derek started talking.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they were like, "Who the hell is this guy?"
Yeah. How's he doing?
But I don't think he's very ambitious. You know, he's like this slow talking Northern Ontario dude who just wants to be out at the cabin. Really, that's all he wants in life. So I don't think.
Well, some dudes get if you get too comfortable, you stay there. You know, what do you got to make your life miserable? Well, you get popular there. You want to come here and be nobody?
Yeah, I think his notion was just I want to make enough money doing stand up that I can go out to the cabin every year.
Yeah, I mean it's a nice one.
So he tours and plays theaters in Canada,
and then he takes some time off.
So funny.
Yeah.
And he's one of those guys that, I always said there's people who can be amazingly successful and not work that hard just because of their talent.
Right.
And then there are other people that maybe aren't that talented, but they can be successful because they just work harder than everybody.
True.
And then you get some people that are crazy talented who work really hard.
Yeah.
And that's what he was like. He worked, I don't think he had great ambitions.
Right.
I'm talking like he's dead. He doesn't have great ambitions, I don't think. Other than he wants his act to be really good.
Right.
So that dude, he had so much natural ability to be funny. And then you'd see him at, middle of the afternoon at a coffee shop with his notebook, just hammering away at jokes. And you're like, God damn,
Yeah.
You got to work that hard and be that funny.
And he made a good life for himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Without having to, be the biggest star in the world.
Yeah.
So
look him up sometime, Derek Edwards.
I'd like to. I'm surprised I haven't seen him.
He's good buddies with Wilmot. Him and Wilmot were like
peas in a pod, each other.
They would go up they would leave their wives behind, go up into the bush and do God knows what.
Yeah.
And just come back haggard, they'd been.
What do you mean, God knows what? I know Wilmot. I've seen him at festivals. I know exactly what he's doing.
He's like a health nut now.
Is he? Good.
Yeah.
Probably had to be.
Yeah, I think he had a bit of a health scare. And
probably
then
got
now
scared, yeah.
He runs.
Oh, good.
He doesn't smoke. I don't think he drinks.
He quit smoking and drinking?
Yeah.
Mike?
And he's like, he probably weighs the same as you.
Well, he's like about my age, our age, I'm a little older than you, right? But he looked like he was.
No, he was younger than me. But
he's
just
younger than me. Right. He looked like.
He looked hardcore.
Oh, yeah.
All those things. Just talk like that all the time. He was like that great kind of fun, drunk uncle.
Yeah.
Hey, you guys there.
So funny.
Yeah, so funny.
Still funny? Healthy?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
He kills, and he's so funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great that he turned around.
Yeah. Well, I think I don't know the details. I think I get the vibe he had a health scare.
Sure.
And said, I got to turn this train around.
Good
and
for him.
And then he's got he's got that intestinal fortitude to do it.
Yeah, that's great.
I don't know if I would. I think I'd be like, I should just lay down and die then.
No, you wouldn't.
I'm not going to go running.
No, I know. You assume that, but when the blood tests come back and it's sort of like you've got about one working heart valve, you're going to be like, all right. So
that's
in
my family too. The heart thing. Yeah. That's what I got to look out for.
Well, are you getting checked up?
Yeah, I started seeing a cardiologist preemptively to stay on top because that's my family's thing.
Is it cholesterol or just?
I don't know what it is.
Yeah,
I don't know what it is. My dad died at 68. All his brothers all died. Quite young, except for one of them.
So you're on the statins?
No, I'm not on anything. Everything's working fine.
Wow, that's good.
I'm just, and I quit smoking years ago. I smoked for 20 years.
Yeah.
I started when I was 17. When I was 27, I realized I'd been smoking for 10 years, and I made a promise to myself, I won't smoke more than 20.
Yeah.
And so I took it right to the 20 years, 37, I wrapped it up.
So you do comedy on the road, and then you come back. So how does... Like it's always been my assumption, probably wrongfully, that if you're talented and you work hard in Canada, eventually they'll give you a show. At least
like
for
a
season.
Socialized entertainment.
Yeah.
I know you're being kind of facetious, but it's not that cut and dry.
Right.
But the notion is it's a small pool of talent, and if you are able to attain some level of success, they'll try you out sometimes on things. But that's certainly not a blanket statement because there are a million really funny Canadian guys who headline clubs and do great. And, there was a time when, the big knock against Canadian broadcasters was you couldn't get them to come out to the... I know, for me, the big difference between American and Canadian networks, as a young comedian when I was starting out, when I was, 25, I had a lot of heat. People were like, oh, this kid's a funny young kid from Canada.
Yeah.
And so the difference between American and Canadian executives, I couldn't get a meeting with Canadian television executives.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew who I was. I was, supposed to be the hot guy, I couldn't get a meeting. Come down to LA. I had meetings with NBC, CBS, and ABC.
Because they want the new guy.
And they were all like, okay, who the hell are you? What do you do? We don't know anything about you. What's your deal? They don't want to miss out on.
Right, exactly. We hear you're hot.
There's some rumor you can do something. What is it? Can I make a buck off it?
Yeah.
I had meetings at these big networks.
And what happened?
And, nothing came of it, but they took me in. They had me read for stuff and all that kind of. And I was like, why the hell? And even it took years and years later before I finally pitched a show that got sold in Canada.
But what's the answer to that? Why the hell was it like that?
I think it came down to individuals. I think during that time, there was a lot of complacent executives.
Mm-hmm.
Who?
What was on TV at that time? What were you guys watching? What were you guys jealous of?
We were
watching
American television. Mostly.
No great Canadian comedies?
Kids in the Hall was the big thing, but that was, Lorne Michaels produced that. So that was...
But that was a big thing when we were grown-ups already.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, in our 20s, yeah.
Yeah. So how did it pan out? You come down here, you didn't get any traction, and you're still doing clubs.
Well, I never really came... I came down here for a matter of a few months.
Right, to meet and shit.
But I came back to Canada. I was busy. The thing was, I just had a good... I was making a living.
Headlining.
Playing clubs, I was booked every week, and I was...
How did it run? Like, so you go back to places three times a year?
Yeah, that
kind
of thing.
Right, and there was about 20 places, and that was your year?
Yeah.
Right.
And a lot of one-nighters.
Sure.
It was a good number of one-nighters. So, and I started doing a lot of corporate shows. And I was just busy and, you know, because I can work very clean for, I mostly work clean. I don't have it was never a conscious decision to.
Yeah.
But, and then the weird thing now is because I've worked clean for so long, mainly, people assume I'm a clean. So now I'll go, and then I had this success on TV with the show that the whole family could enjoy, really.
Yeah, right.
It was a primetime sitcom, but, you know. So now I will go do a show and there'll be, I look down and somebody's got their 8-year-old kid in the front row and it's like, it's a stand-up show.
It's the worst. It's the worst.
And I'm not filthy, but I might be talking about my taxes. You know?
So I was in Vancouver and some woman brought a baby and that turned into a whole, turned into a very weird story. So how do you develop a show? Like, so you come up with Corner Gas.
The way that worked for me was, I was just going about my business doing stand-up, and this director I know, David Story, who had directed a one-off comedy thing that I had done, he came to me, he called me up, he said, look, I'm in Vancouver, let's go for coffee. I want to talk to you about
something. You were living in Vancouver?
Yeah. I've lived in Vancouver for about 26 years or something.
You live in Vancouver now?
Yeah. Why last 26 years
I didn't
or
realize that. I love Vancouver.
Yeah.
Why didn't I realize that? Did I see you in Vancouver?
You're a busy guy. I don't know. I saw you once in Vancouver at... I was coming back from lunch with Kindler during the festival there.
Oh, yeah.
And we bumped into each other. But anyway, so this director says, let's go for coffee. I want to talk to you about something. He says, I've been talking to the network.
Yeah.
And they want to know if you have any show ideas. Because I had just done... I'd been nominated for Best Comedy Performance for the stand-up show I'd done on the CTV network.
Right.
And so they were kind of, he's a funny guy. He just got some heat with the special.
Yeah.
Nominated for an award. So this director had been talking to the network about some of his show ideas. They weren't keen on his show ideas, but they said, you know Brent Butt.
Yeah.
Does he have any show ideas? So he came to me and said, do you have any show ideas? I said, well, the only thing that I wrote this treatment for a show about a gas station in the middle of Saskatchewan, but I can't imagine they'd be interested in that. He said, well, I'll talk to them about it. He came back and said, yeah, they're interested. So flush it out a bit. So I flushed it out some more. You know, I had this 4-page treatment. I hammered it out more, made it more detailed.
Yeah.
I kept thinking they were going to not be interested.
It was like, it was
just
set.
And then they kept being interested.
In an isolated gas station?
Yeah, the notion was it was just, it's kind of like, for me, the notion, well, what would my life be like if I hadn't pursued show business? I don't really have any marketable skills. I used to hang out at the gas station a lot.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's probably what I'd be doing. So it's kind of premised on the life of, if I hadn't pursued comedy, I would be running the gas station in small rural Saskatchewan.
And that gas station has a little grocery and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's a coffee shop attached.
Okay, there you go. So that's it.
And so this the coffee shop had always been run by this woman named Ruby. She passed away, and she willed it to her niece.
Yeah.
Who is from Toronto, and she comes out to this small rural town. So it's kind of a fish out of water.
Sure, but you're a local.
Yeah, I'm a local. She's the only fish out of water.
And it's like, is there a romance, or is it like the Ted Danson thing where there's a romantic tension between you two?
Yeah, romantic tension between the two. And then we did 6 years of that, and then we did a movie.
But
at the end of the movie, you find out that my character and her have been dating for 2 years and nobody in town knows it.
Oh.
It kind of goes against the trope of everybody knows everybody's business in a small town.
Right.
Everybody's like, what the hell are you guys
doing? So the entire country was invested in this. Like, this is...
Yeah, had the crazy...
Well, this is a unique thing because...
It is.
This is a huge show.
There are no Canadian hit shows. That's always been the rule, right?
No, but like, I don't know the show.
No, it is.
But like, in the sense that like, it was a huge success in Canada. You were on a series for 6 years.
And it's the only time in history that the number one comedy in Canada wasn't from America. It was the only, I'm very proud of that. We were actually the number one, we weren't the number one Canadian comedy. We were the number one comedy at the time. We were ahead of, you know, all the big U.S.
People were probably
shows.
Proud almost. There's probably a national sense of pride.
It seems to be. Like when people talk about it, they were, you know.
Because these were Canadian people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think one of the reasons it had success or connected with people is that, you know, we weren't hiding the fact that we were Canadian, which some shows would do.
They
would be nebulous as to where they were to try and appeal to a U.S. market.
Right.
We weren't that. We said we were Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
But that's all. It was never about being there, really. It was never about Saskatchewan. People would say, it's a show about, you know, Saskatchewan. You go, no, it's not. It's a show about. And that's why it had this appeal. It played in 26 countries. And
it did?
You know, we had guys. Yeah, I would have guys from Sweden say, it's just like the village I grew up in, Sweden.
Right.
And I would have guys from Manhattan say, this is just like my neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
Because it had a real universality.
It had a run here?
Yeah, it came on WGN Superstation.
Okay.
For a couple years or something. And now it's on, now it's in 60 countries. The original series, not the animated one, although we're hoping that that'll launch in the U.S. soon. The original 107 episodes plays on Amazon Prime. So, and it's taken off there.
No shit.
The numbers are, you know, you have experts going into it who are saying, like, you could expect X amount. It's blowing all those experts.
So you still get the residuals?
No, we don't really do a residual system in Canada.
Ah.
Which for, in 99% of the time, that's a good system. They do a buyout system.
Yeah.
The only time it's not a real good system is when you have a hit.
Yeah. So now you just sit there and watch it have this life.
But I've done well by the show. You know, once it's a hit show, you negotiate your fees forward instead of backward is all.
No, I get it. But like, you know, here, I guess.
But yeah, I'll never be Jennifer Aniston.
This is one of the appeals of coming to the States is that, you know, Jerry Seinfeld's a billionaire.
Yeah. And I have no problem paying my hydro bill. That's the difference between, that's Canadian success.
Yeah. So, okay, so this ran for five or six years. It did 100
six
how many?
Seasons. 6 seasons, 107 episodes. And then I wrapped it up. The network wanted more shows, but I was like, we got to do something else.
Yeah.
We're all getting older. So 5 years later, the idea was, let's come back a few years later and do a movie. And that'll be the cherry on top.
Yeah.
So we did that. We did the movie.
Was it successful?
Theatrical release and everything. And then it was like the most watched. It got the award that year for most eyeballs or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And so the movie did great.
See, that's weird. Here we call those ratings.
Yeah, but we don't know the technical term of it. We just call it
eyeball.
But it sold out theaters. Like my brother called me up and said, I can't get into your goddamn movie. And I was all mad.
Elmer?
Lloyd, actually.
Oh, okay.
And so anyway, and the theaters, it was supposed to have a limited run. The success was, it was drawing enough numbers. The theaters negotiated with the network to have a longer window so we could keep it in theaters longer.
Yeah.
It did great business. And so then the network, you know, called me up again and said, listen, there's clearly still an appetite. Do you want to do something? You want to do more episodes? And I just didn't think it was the right thing. Me and my partners, we didn't think it was right to just go back and do more episodes. Yeah. But you like the idea of having a gig. So what could we do differently? And I have this history of illustrating and cartooning. And we had talked about, we had kicked around the notion of doing an animated scene in one of the episodes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we said, well, what if we did an animated version of the show? Let's kick that idea around. And so I was in the fortunate position to know a guy named Norm Hiscock. Do you know Norm Hiscock? He's a comedy writer.
I feel like I've heard
he wrote
name.
Kids in the Hall and Saturday Night Live and everything. He was one of the writers on Corner Gas.
Yeah.
And he was a writer on King of the Hill.
Yeah.
So here's a guy who knows our show and knows primetime animation.
Right.
So I went to him right away and I said, listen.
Is he Canadian?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, we're thinking about doing an animated version of Corner Gas, primetime animated.
Yeah.
What would we change? What would we do different? And he just emphatically said, don't do anything different. This is the perfect show to animate. So we brought him on to help develop the show to make an animated show.
And where's that at now?
Season one was big hit. Broke the record for, what did you say, ratings?
Eyeballing? Yeah, eyeballs.
The most people.
Most eyeballs?
We broke Charlie Sheen's record on the Comedy Network. The biggest debut of a show was Anger Management.
Uh-huh.
Oh, and so we got that. Now it's Corner Gas Animated.
That was built to syndicate globally, and no one watches it here.
So anyway, it's a big hit, and so we got the second season. We're in the works of that now.
So that's amazing. Like it's like, and in Canada, I guess, well, you have all the stuff, you have streaming and everything else, but there's still a pretty lively, just basic TV audience, like for CBC stuff, or is it?
Yeah, I think so. It's across the board. It's declining like everywhere else. Yeah,
right.
It's a network show. I mean, the animated version airs on cable first on the Comedy Network, which is like the Canadian version of Comedy Central.
Yeah.
Comedy Network, it airs there first, and then airs in the summer on the main network, CTV.
So you,
and then it streams in Canada on Crave, which is a Canadian streaming service.
Yeah.
But outside of Canada, it's on Amazon Prime.
I got to watch. Now I know where to watch it.
But not the animated isn't streaming outside Canada yet.
Okay.
Only the original.
The original's on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
The original corner. Now, what was Hiccups?
Hiccups was the follow-up. After I kind of said we don't do any more corner gas, they said, would you like to do another
You're
show?
You're a bona fide comedy star.
Yeah, let's see if you can do it again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so we did, I came up with this other idea for a show called Hiccups.
Yeah.
Which is about a child, a very popular children's book author who has emotional issues.
Yeah.
She has anger management issues and other emotional hiccups. And so that's what we did next. We did the series.
That's with
that.
Your wife?
Yeah. So Nancy Robertson, who was an actor that we hired to come on Corner Gas and play the retail assistant Wanda on Corner Gas, she and I hit it off during the filming of Corner Gas.
That's
and we
nice.
Ended up getting married.
Show business couple.
Yeah.
Canadian power show business couple.
Power couple.
Yeah.
Damn straight.
Show business power couple. Now tell me about the Peter Ustinov Award.
The Peter Ustinov Award is an award that the Comedy Network gives out at the Banff Television Award, I guess. And it signifies a significant body of comedic work.
Like a lifetime achievement type of deal.
Yeah.
And you got one of those.
Yeah.
Was Peter Ustinov Canadian?
No, but he spent a lot of time in Canada.
Oh.
He loved Canada.
I just
he always said Toronto is like if New York was run by the Swiss. That was his famous line.
So, like, all said, you know, you got a great life and a great career, and but here in the States, you know, you're fairly obscure.
Yeah.
You know, I know you from working in Canada, but is that ever something that haunts you in any way? Do you wish that, because I know there are cats that, you know, come down and either from England or forever, and they try to get some traction here, and they really want it, and it doesn't necessarily happen. Do you have that experience?
No, not really. I mean, I would love to be a huge, it's a big market. It'd be big money if I was a big star
Stand
here.
Up, yeah.
But when I came down to LA, I kind of did that, I chased the showbiz thing for about 6 months down here.
Yeah.
And there was real palpable opportunity. You could see it. And I had interest from managers. Jimmy Miller was like a big champion of me for a long time, really helped me out. And Mike McDonald, God bless him, he introduced me to club owners and stuff, and he was a big supporter. But what I found was when I was down here, I it's hard to put my finger on it. If I was myself on stage, it would go okay.
Yeah.
But I think I have a strange Canadian accent where it's. It's not like real strong East Coast Canadian accent or something. It's not that real kind of tight Ontario accent.
Yeah.
It's not real Fargo-esque.
Right.
It's the closest thing. That, like
Midwestern.
Yeah. Like when I watched Fargo, I couldn't stop laughing because everybody just sounded like my dad.
Yeah.
My dad would like, especially on the phone when the William H. Macy character would be on the phone.
Yeah.
I just, my father on the phone, this was him all the time. He was right, real good. Yeah, real good then. Okay, right? Yeah. All right then, real good. Real good. Right then. So I was just cracking up there in Fargo. But I think my accent...
Was it obstacle?
Was just different enough that people... They were spending the whole time in my act going, where the fuck is this guy
right,
from?
Right, right. It was not American.
Yeah.
But they couldn't figure out
where.
But
it wasn't like a thick Irish brogue.
Right, wasn't a caricature.
I wasn't Yakov Smirnoff.
Right.
So it was... And if I would dial that back and talk more American, I would do much better.
Yeah.
But I didn't enjoy it so much. I felt I wasn't being myself. I felt I wasn't being... The whole time I was on stage, I was just consciously... It was like you playing the Victoria curling rink. You're like, you're ahead of... It's not natural.
Right.
And so I... And then eventually, I didn't have the paperwork to stay here and work.
Right.
So I kind of had to make the decision, what am I going to do? Am I going to pursue this? And it kind of coincided with me getting a lot of traction in Canada and being busy.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like the decision was made for me a bit. And I just think internally there's part of me that as a little kid, I always, because there wasn't a lot of Canadian TV,
yeah,
and I only grew up with two channels, I'd get CBC and CTV, and it was mostly American shows.
Yeah.
And if I ever saw anything Canadian, especially Canadian comedic,
yeah,
I was raptured by it, and I wanted more of it.
Yeah.
And so I grew up kind of wanting to make Canadian comedy.
Yeah.
As like a patriotic thing, something I didn't have much of growing
right,
up.
Sure.
And then people always said, well, you can't, we don't do sitcoms in Canada. I always said, well, there's no reason we couldn't. I mean, yeah. I get the economics of it. A hit show in the States will pay for 50 failures.
Yeah. Right.
We don't have that economic. Yeah. In Canada. You get one shot.
Yeah.
One shot every 5 years at a sitcom. And yeah. So, The you know, you got to bat 1,000, and who right. bats 1,000? So we just happened to come up with a show that worked, that people really liked.
Well, yeah, congratulations. So now you're doing the animated thing, but how, and you're on the road a lot still?
Yeah.
Or, you do theaters, you're a star in Canada. How often you got to turn over your hour? What are you generating?
How often should I turn it over, or do I turn it over?
Well, I mean,
over?
I have to assume.
I don't. I have spent so much time on production and writing scripts for the animated right. show sure, now sure. that I can't turn my act over as much as I would like.
Does that eat at you? I can't deal with it. Or you go out, you were just there like 6 months ago, and you go out with the same act?
It bothers me until you go out and it's working. If it gets big laughs, and then you forget all about it. And so oh, far, yeah. it keeps working. Okay. I mean, I change. I have a, you know, I've been doing stand-up for 30-some years. Yeah. I got a big
sure.
tickle trunk, as we would say in Canada, of Do material.
You? Yeah.
We used to have a show in Canada called Mr. Dress-Up. It was like Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
And he had a tickle trunk.
A tickle trunk.
Yeah. Where he'd pull costumes out. And let's see what's in the tickle trunk.
Well, it's funny, though, when you're sort of like, you know, when I did that bit, people didn't really know me. So there's a lot of people that have never heard that bit.
Yeah. Well, there is some of that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you're like, that was a great bit. I spent 6 months making that bit work, and then I put it on TV, and I fucking buried it. I'm pulling that out.
You can retool it, some stuff. Like, I just started redoing I was going through an old notebook of mine because I had this concern. I was like, God damn, I got to start pulling some different stuff out.
Yeah.
Because I was playing a show at this casino where I kind of come back every year.
Yeah.
And I was like, I think they're going to start hating me if I don't come up with something new. So I was going through a notebook, and this is when it kind of hit me. Sometimes you see a reference and you realize how long you've been doing it.
Yeah.
I had a bit in my act about push button phones.
Sure.
And I was like, holy Jesus. Yeah. How long have I been doing this?
Yeah.
Anyway, I ended up kind of retooling that into being a bit about how long I've been doing stand-up.
Sure.
Oh, and I great. Kind of told that story, but I had a bit in my act.
And you could do the bit.
So it's a bit of a cheat, kind of, but it works. And people sure. like the story of it.
And, yeah,
you
yeah.
know, as long as there's some kind of authentic grain to it.
Well, yeah, and as you get older, you get more, you know, grounded in yourself, and you can talk a little freer about yourself.
Yeah, right? And I think you have, for good or bad, I think you start to get less hung up on all those little kind of
yeah
anxieties and
yeah. There's certainly I have found that like I don't have the same fears, but that one fear of repeating myself is a real one. You know, like and then you start to realize like, well, like just even 5 years ago, I wasn't selling the amount of tickets I've been selling now. And like right. you think all these people have listened to every one of my records or seen yeah. any of my specials?
You're crazy.
There's one special that you can't even find the fucking thing.
Yeah. So I'll fold that in, man.
Yeah.
Don't let that go.
No, I know. It's like it is kind of crazy. But then like because of that pressure I put on myself.
That thick Irish brogue yeah. that Mark Maron is known for.
You know, I eventually somehow churn out you know, a good new hour every year and a half or 2 years just out of compulsion.
But is it really good though, Mark?
It gets there.
But that's the too. There's one of the insecurities that I think all stand-ups have, especially if you know, once you've had some success and yeah. you're a guy who can go out and get big laughs, right?
Right,
you're
right.
that guy.
Yeah.
And you're used to it.
Yeah.
And you're hooked on that.
Right.
Now, you go out and you got a bunch of new stuff. And it's maybe not as honed.
Yeah.
It doesn't have 10 yeah. years in the clubs behind yeah, yeah. it. And it's not getting the laughs you're used to. And you just bail on it. You yeah. throw down a smoke pellet and haul out the old bits. Right?
Yeah. I don't do that as much because what I'll do is I'll do like, I'll get a small space and do like a workshop. Instead of doing it on the road, I'll do it at a, like a residency at a theater once a week, you know, for a month or two, where I'll just like, you know, have make sure it's my fans, low expectations. I'll ramble through an hour and a half and try to keep breaking it down, because you try to kind of, once you start sandwiching those half-baked bits into the well-worn ones, you know, you can always
another
come
great
back.
Canadian snack, the half-baked bits, if you ever get a chance to. Made with real Canadian bits.
Yeah, you know, that's just the job. But no matter what I'm doing.
Yeah, I do that, too. Like, Vancouver's got a great club called the Comedy Mix. And it's, you know, it's not a big club. It's a little
club. That little place, that's great.
Yeah, it's a little club. So I'll go down there and work on new bits.
That's the way to do it, right?
That's fantastic.
Fuck it. And then, like, no expectations. No one's paying the big bread.
And I pop up unannounced, so nobody has, like, paid a ticket to see me. I just come up and do 10 or 15 minutes of new stuff.
Isn't that rewarding, though? Even if it doesn't work as good?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like.
Because I miss playing the clubs.
Well, the other thing about that is that, like, you know, there is that thing where you have bits that you know work, but then you're doing the new bits and they're not quite there yet. But that first time that, you know, you in a low pressure situation and it hits, that's the real fucking laugh.
Yeah.
That you know, it's not just doing the job. That's the, I'm still funny.
Yeah, still got it. Yeah. It's like, whew.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I think there is that fear. That's one of the insecurities.
I still do it? Yeah.
You know, I put out a tweet a little while ago where I said, you know, I was just up early in the morning. I'm having a coffee, and I tweeted out, nothing says I'm a vibrant contemporary part of the comedy scene like being up at 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning for no reason.
Yeah.
Like the notion of that when I was 30, of being up at 7 a.m. on Saturday for Sunday for no reason.
Yeah.
Because I would have gone to bed at 4 or 5.
Well, now you're just an old guy.
And you get
just
up. An old dude. Right?
Yeah, you get up.
My wife and I go to, we hit the sack about 10. We watch a Miss Marple and then I'm up at 7.
Yeah, I get that thing where it's just sort of like, you know, when I've got to start from scratch, like, you know what I mean? Where I don't know, like that moment where you're like, I don't, where does it come from? How do I do this?
Yeah. Well, I think part of the thing is when we were, you know, just in the clubs every night doing it
making it, scribbling all the time.
You're never really, maybe I'm just speaking for myself, but it never felt to me like I was, you didn't have that workload of like sitting down and just put 3 hours today and hammer some stuff together because you're doing a show every night. So you're just kind of, you're going and doing the show, having a couple drinks, hanging with your buddies.
And then wandering
that's
around.
The work.
Yeah, then wandering around all day, thinking.
But the work, that's not the work anymore.
No,
because we're not in the clubs every night.
That's true.
So now the work is, I got to sit down at the kitchen table and really do some actual writing.
Yeah, I don't do that. I can't stand it. Like, you know, like when I have a day off from shooting and I don't have any interviews or whatever, where I don't have anything to do, I'm like, this is what I was working for. This is how I spent most of my life. Because, you're in the clubs, you're doing shows every night, but you're also doing nothing.
Yeah.
You're just wandering around with your notebook and then you'll have coffee and then you'll walk a few blocks and be like, oh, shit, I'm going to write that down. And
but
that's that.
But you're also driven by the fact that you
get up on stage.
You know, they're about to cut your phone off because you haven't paid the bill in 2 months. And now your bills are paid.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, sure.
You've put in these years of battling. You become the old polar bear.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You can put the battle armor down. And,
yeah. I wish. I have. I do. But thank God my brain's still a fucking mess.
That's your bread and butter.
Yeah.
That's right. That's what, don't ever lose that. Well, that's one of my things is like, and I don't know if it makes me question whether my whole life isn't just a load of bullshit because you always hear about, the best comedy comes from angst and, you know, and I just never had any of that. I grew up very, you know, my parents were pretty cool. My siblings and I got along.
But you do have the, failure's okay. So that's just as good as angst. You know what I mean? Like the sort of defeatism, you know.
I've pre-defeated myself.
Right. That's the other way. You're gonna.
Be onto something. This could be a whole revolutionary angle of psychotherapy where you just say to people, "Listen, just pre-defeat yourself, and you'll get rid of the anxiety."
You're already a
failure.
Sure. Dread. I'm a big Dread fan. Like, but, I'm not going to go do, like, that's going to be terrible.
What is it about, I don't have that. I don't want to bomb, but I'm fine with bombing. At the end of the day, it's like, it's not, I don't have somebody's child's life in my hands, you know?
Sure,
if I remember when I was dated this girl years ago, and I went on a double date with her friend and her boyfriend. Her boyfriend was like this vice cop in Toronto.
Right.
And I remember him saying to me, well, I would never have the nerve to do what you do. And I was like, didn't you kick in the door to a crack house today? Yeah. Like, how do you, where does that, like, I never take a shotgun blast to the chest. Like, if I'm having a bad day, if I make the wrong decision, you know, I get up tomorrow, try it again.
You'll beat the shit out of yourself a little, but you're not going to take a shotgun
but
blast.
I don't know. There's something about, I've always wanted to do well, but I've never put too much gravity on it or something.
Oh, that's good. That's a good way to go about.
But I wonder if it isn't like some sort of bullshit mask. Because I hear that from people. People say to me, "Oh, you know, you're very grounded and you're very calm."
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the case. But then I sometimes think, well, is that just, you know? Do you ever? That's my anxiety. My anxiety is: am I really this calm? Is this all bullshit?
They don't have therapy in Canada.
Yeah, but it's socialized and it's not, you know. Everybody's got to work as a therapist for 2 weeks, so they're not good at it. It's some guy who was a milkman the week before.
Well, you do discover things about yourself. I mean, it's a matter of wanting to. Maybe you shouldn't question it too much. It seems to be working for you.
I just wanted to laugh. I just like the laugh. I don't think there's more to it than that for me.
But also, you were the last kid. Was there a struggle for attention?
I think so. I think there's that.
Yeah.
And if I could make my older brothers or sisters there laugh, that was a great, because it didn't come easy. They wouldn't give it up easy kid.
Yeah.
So if you made them laugh, you knew it was legit, and that was a high.
See that? You learned your craft by wanting to be liked by your siblings.
Yeah.
There you go.
Let the beatings stop for 2 minutes.
That's the next special title.
I'm planning on doing a special this year because I've never done one. And almost for posterity's sake, I want to get it out to say I was here, you know, that's what I did. And Corner Gas is partly that bit of posterity, part of my stamp.
Yeah.
But I was also, you know, I'm a stand-up, so I want some of my stand-up out there more. So I'm going to do a special this year, so I'm kicking around titles.
Well, good, man. Well, I'm glad that, you know, that this Corner Gas is something you can do for the rest of your life. It's great.
Here's hoping. And, well, that's one of the things about doing it animated now, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how old or bald or fat, as long as I kind of sound the same. Great.
That's why I love doing this, and I can do it in my house.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we got it done. What are you doing down here?
I had a couple of meetings. I have an agency down here. We're talking about some stuff. And
Corner Gas American style?
Well, you know, the notion is to get Corner Gas down streaming in the state. The animated version streaming the way that...
Oh, good.
So there's interest in that. And
yeah.
And just talking about stuff, keeping the machine going, you know.
All right, man. Well, I'm glad we made time for this, Brent.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
Sure. I'll see you up in Canada. There you go, Canada. Me and Brent Butt, and I'm talking to you right now from Hamilton, Ontario. It's all coming together. The forces, it's Canada Day here a few days early. You can subscribe to Brent's YouTube channel, The Butt Pod. You can also find him on Twitter, Instagram, and at brentbutt.com. His show, Corner Gas, I believe, is animated now, and you can go watch that somewhere. Oh, my God, you guys. Shooting is tiring. I know, again, these are what they call luxury problems in the recovery racket, but I'm going to go out. It looks like I have a little time, so I'm going to go enjoy Hamilton. The Hammer. Boomer lives!